The Lakers.
Yeah,
that's right.
Right.
None of them will outmatch one another. To be fair.
Good catch.
By our speaker tonight, because Russell Schreiber has written an outstanding book, Gurdjieff's Transformational Psychology. Many books have been written about the Fourth Way, Gurdjieff's Fourth Way, but few have added substantive new perspective to the Fourth Way tradition. This book does that. That is an achievement which we should all be grateful for. Unfortunately, I was not here last time that our guest spoke about that book, but I suspect some of the same material will at least be referenced, perhaps a little bit, in this talk. I know that he has been a student of the Fourth Way, a practitioner of the Fourth Way, a teacher of the Fourth Way for decades, and we are so grateful for his presence here tonight. I'm looking forward to this talk myself personally. Please join me in welcoming Russell Schreiber.
So where to begin? One of the things I thought about this quote-unquote talk is that I wanted to make it more of a conversation. So in the sense that I'm going to pause at different times and questions that people have from their own experience, from reading Gurdjieff, from reading students of Gurdjieff, or any other questions that come up given your life experience, I want to allow them, really encourage them to be asked. I was thinking, you know, how to begin, and I'm not sure how many of you ever saw a film called The Meaning of Life. Does anyone ever remember this film? Couple here, Monty Python.
Oh.
Okay, Meaning of Life, right? You know, so there's a it's an interesting film. There's a sequence in the film I was thinking about as I was driving today, and it takes place in this very, not a mythical city, but supposedly London, and it's a huge high-rise, not a high-rise, I guess a corporate building. At the top of the corporate building is this large conference room, and the conference room has this incredibly long table set out in it, and this is supposed to be like the ultimate corporation in the world. And the CEO is sitting at the head of the table, and he has all of his officers sitting around it, and he asks them to report on what they have found going on around the world. And the reason is that they want to figure out where we're going to make our money. This is the question. So they go around, they report, and one person starts off and he says, well, we have noted through research that men are wearing, they're wearing hats more now, top hats, this year. And the CEO sits there and he goes, very interesting. And it moves from person to person. And then somewhere along the line, one person says, you know, there's something going around here, there's an idea. And it's very, you know, it's out there in the, people are talking about it now, and it has to do with the fact that humanity, people, maybe are not fully awake. And perhaps, they have moments of waking up, but perhaps a lot of the problems that are going on in the world have to do with their state of consciousness maybe isn't fully awake. And that's what's said in maybe a couple of more sentences. Then it continues around the table. And the CEO finally, at the end, he's thinking about all the things, he looks around at all the people, and he says, you know, that thing about people wearing, that men wearing more hats, that really sounds important. You know, and it's just one of those things sort of thrown into that film. It's a very interesting film. And so anyway, that little piece there about people not being fully awake, that was coming from off of Mr. Gurdjieff's table. And Let me just also say that I became very interested in Gurdjieff, not as the answer or the man, but because I was rather disappointed in psychology at Berkeley in the 1960s. I got there in about 64. And I had some experiences that paralleled Gurdjieff's. And I just want to give a little bit of background for people who don't know, but Gurdjieff was born in about, they believe, around 1877 in what today would be Armenia, but at that time was Russia. And it was in flux, that area. And when I say in flux, I mean there was a lot of warfare. So there's a lot of violence going on all around him. And he became very interested in medicine and psychology. And specifically, he became very interested in what is this all about? Why is there so much violence? Why is there so this violence in the world? Why are people killing each other everywhere? And when I say this parallels my own experience, when I was at Berkeley and I arrived in December of 1964, it was the beginning of what was called in this country the free speech movement. All right, and so Berkeley was in a turmoil, and you had shootings at Kent State, you had the Vietnam War starting, and what happened was I went through various stages of almost being drafted, so forth and so on, but I was looking around and I'm going, what is this about? Why is there this violence that's taking place? Okay, in other words, because we had violence on the campus, all right, a lot of violence on the campus at that point. And the people who were protesting freedom of speech, who were supposed to be nonviolent, were also becoming violent, all right? So this was an interesting thing to me, and here I am at Berkeley studying psychology, and they're studying rats, okay, basically. That was the study. They were studying rats. And all around me was this laboratory of people psychologically having these experiences. So I got very interested in what was going on. So why is there all this violence? Why Vietnam? Why the response of people to Vietnam? And I did my degree at Berkeley, and then I was very frustrated because I did not find anything real. I found a lot of theories, but I couldn't find anything real. Gurdjieff had the same problem. He looked at medicine, he looked at sociology, he looked at economics. He couldn't find an understanding for the reason people were killing themselves and others, what he called reciprocal destruction. He couldn't find a reason for it. So that's what began his search. And in his search, what he found gradually was, although it might appear that it was economics, it might appear that it was for power, it might appear all sorts of ways the reason people were killing each other and why the earth was in this constant warfare, that what was actually the reason, the underlying reasons, were actually inside the psychology of human beings. There was something that had happened in human beings that he became very interested in, and he was looking for what that was about. And and then about 1915, he, after about 20 some odd years of searching, 15 I guess, well, almost 20 years of searching, because he started probably in the late 1890s, he came into Russia and began to teach at that time. And hi, how are you? Seat right there.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. So he began to teach groups of people. A lot of people became interested. Mathematicians, philosophers, poets, artists, people who were involved in dance and movement. And he began to lay out some basic premises about humanity, and specifically about their state of consciousness, the state of consciousness that they live in most of the time. And in this talk tonight, one of the things I was going to focus on was three specific areas that I find interesting because of the way the world is at the present time. And that is, although I live in Sonoma County, and we all do, and we live in relative safety. I think people would agree, would you agree with that? In other words, we're not worried about, at the moment, we're not worried about the National Guard coming in or a bomb threat, hopefully, or anything of that sort. So we live in relative safety, and yet at the same time, we have an awareness of, there's some awareness of the fact that things could change rather rapidly. In other words, there are things happening in the Middle East that have been going on in most of our lifetime since the end of World War II, and it's disturbing because there does not appear after some, see, 1945, we're looking at almost 70 years now, it does not appear that there have been tremendous strides in finding out why we have this strife, why we have all the reciprocal destruction going on. And I'm going to try and really talk from a couple of different directions, but I want to relate Gurdjieff's ideas to current psychology, in that something's happened around what I call and refer to as the natural emotional affects in human beings. And affects are examples such as anger. It's an emotion, an affect. Shame is an affect. Fear is an affect. And I'm going to sort of pivot on those three because they seem to be the most dysregulated. And what I mean by that is, let me give you a simple example. Fear is there as something that helps us mediate with the external environment. You know, if you walk up to a cliff, your body looks and goes, ah, something in you tells you instinctively, this is dangerous, all right? I'm not supposed to step over here. I could be hurt. I could be killed. And likewise, if somebody threatens you actually physically, there's fear. But, so it's a very natural thing, fear. And actually, it's put there for a reason in human beings because it actually has potential to allow us to develop certain capacities. An example, fear, if my fear is sitting in my left hand, the capacity that I can develop as a human being is confidence, courage. You see? In other words, I can find a way to be able to hold fear. I can learn to be a mountain climber, or I can learn to be a psychologist, or I can learn to be a businessman in any way. So I still have a certain amount of fear, and yet I sort of like use that, and I actually grow because of the fear. But what's happened with fear is it's become distorted as a normal function. And the way that happens is, do you guys remember Pavlov, you know, with the bell and the meat powder and the dog, you know, salivating? Well, what Pavlov found out, you know, is, you know, if I ring a bell and then I present meat powder, the dog, a dog, normal dog, will start to salivate. All right? And then gradually, what he did is he removed the meat powder. Well, you know, if dogs smell meat powder, they salivate like crazy. But he removed the meat powder and he just rang the bell and the dog went ahead and it salivates. Okay? So, what does it have to do with fear and the way the world is now? What does it have to do with Gurdjieff's ideas? It has to do because what's happened is, whether we realize it or not, fear for most people in the society has become associated with things that don't necessarily or shouldn't necessarily bring up fear. An example is, I write a check to somebody and, oops, I wonder, do I have enough money in the bank? I become afraid, all right? And so fear, unintentionally, becomes associated with, I don't have enough money in the bank, writing a bad check. Or I perhaps fail a test. Or my parents say to me, you know, you've got to do really well on this test, or I'm going to be angry. So now fear becomes associated with hundreds of things in our society. Can people see how that is for themselves? Any questions? I'm just curious if people have a statement, question, anything. Okay.
So how does this all fit in with the idea of Kunde
Buffer? With the idea of Kunde Buffer. Okay. I will get to that. And I'll answer. And your first name?
Robert.
Okay. It fits in actually pretty easily in a certain way because, and it's a more modern concept, but a more modern concept of the psyche or psychology is the human psyche, is that you and I, Robert, are not a single entity, but rather we're a multiplicity. We have different parts, all right? In other words, so that concept of a multiplicity is perhaps, really about 20 years old in current psychology. The idea that I might have very disparate parts. I might have a part that really wants to be a very responsible human being, another part that really wants to gamble. Now, these two parts very often don't really know each other. In extreme cases, in something like dissociative identity disorder or multiple personality disorder, they don't know each other so much so that a person can go out and get into a fight and gamble, do all these things, and has no memory the following day of what he did. Gurdjieff pointed out the fact that we're a multiplicity in 1912. All right, so he was about almost 100 years ahead of anyone else. And what he named it, he gave the example of, he said, there's something in the human psyche that is like a buffer. He called it Kunde Buffer. The word has come down to us, it's sort of bastardized now, Kundalini Yoga. All right, Kunda. But the concept was that there's a buffer between the different parts of the psyche. Now, how that came about, it's not talked about a lot in psychology, nor is the concept of an unconscious talked about, other than the fact that from Carl Jung's time forward, we start to look at the unconscious, and yet no one, very rarely, does anyone ever ask, well, why is there an unconscious? How did that come about? So this concept of Kunde Buffer, multiplicity, and the fact that there's an unconscious or part of us, a part of our consciousness we're not aware of, is relatively, Kunde Buffer, multiplicity, very recent, last 20 years, people are sort of looking at it a little bit. Why there's an unconscious? Not a lot of interest in it. So, Gurdjieff was probably the first person at that time to point out that there are, what he said, four states of consciousness that we have. We have our everyday consciousness. So most everybody was active today doing things, correct? Everyone was doing things, pretty much? Okay. So you did a lot of things, right? I mean, we went from thing to thing. Let's stand up for a second, okay? Just to make this a little experiential, all right? Okay. So, close your eyes and stand. So, just gently direct your attention to the fact that you have balance, that your body is balancing ever so slightly. And then expand your consciousness from this balance, your attention, and bring it to your breath, to air going in and out of your nostrils. So you're standing,
You're noticing your balance. You have a gentle attention on your breathing. You might notice sounds outside. We breathe roughly approximately 17,000 times a day. We're balancing all the time. And we know if we have a problem with our balance, if we're dizzy, or we have vertigo, or we slip. So this state that we're in right now that I'm bringing your attention to is closer to what's called the state of self-consciousness. You can notice your breathing in and out. You can notice that you're balancing. You might notice that you have some particular thought. You know, perhaps, why is he making me do this? This is not fun. Or you might notice a feeling, you're even a little annoyed about it. But you tend to be self-conscious. This is a state that is closer to self-consciousness. And it's different from your normal state during the day. There is more an emphasis on the fact that you are being, that you just are existing in this moment, just breathing. This is actually our normal state of consciousness, what would be truly a normal state for human beings. And it's not a state usually that most people are able to maintain in the midst of their lives. Okay, let's stop. Sit down. So, questions, or what do people notice? You know, do people notice anything just standing there being in that state?
Well, it's just like meditation. And if you were to stay in that state all day long, you wouldn't get much done.
Perhaps, I agree. You wouldn't get much done.
There's a spaciousness to it in which things occur.
Mm-hmm. And you can be the observer of that. And to know that
you watch
yourself being the observer, even. Exactly. So the general state that we're in, which Christian was talking about, you know, he was saying, you know, boy, if we were in this state the whole day, similar to one of a meditative state, we wouldn't get anything done. And that's probably true. However, let me say a little bit about states of consciousness. One of the things that Gurdjieff found in his studies, in his work, and I don't look at myself as a teacher in any way, shape, or form. I am, what I can say that I actually am, is I'm an explorer. I'm interested in other people. I'm interested in states of consciousness. I'm interested in helping people to find the tools themselves for their own inner development. It's when Rob was reading all the different things that he was talking about, it had to do with inner development, inner possibilities. So Gurdjieff found that there were four basic states of consciousness. The sleeping state of consciousness, there were originally only three, by the way. There was sleep, a normal state of consciousness, which we just had an experience of, which is self-consciousness, and then actually a higher state of consciousness, which is called by various names in all sorts of disciplines. It could be called objective consciousness. It could be called cosmic consciousness. And it's a state of consciousness which denotes not only are you conscious of yourself existing, but that there is some actual truth that you understand. There's something objective. When you're in that state, you've actually come to understand and see definite things about life, about yourself, about the world. And
It's not different from each person, from one person to the other, but perhaps it would actually be common, be objective consciousness. So those are the three states. What Gurdjieff directs us to over a long period of time is there's a middle state that has formed for humanity. It's neither asleep nor is it self-conscious. And he called this state very simply waking sleeping, all right, or sleeping waking. Doesn't make any difference how you say it. It's similar to the fact that if I were to say to most people, okay, at 3 o'clock 3 days ago, what were you doing? You'd have to go back and you have to reconstruct it, because you probably aren't going to remember it, all right? You know, you could reconstruct. You say, well, I was at work. But you wouldn't necessarily remember exactly what you were doing at that moment. It's just the nature, from my experience, it's just the nature of that state of consciousness. Things that happen in the sleeping, waking state of consciousness is a lot of habitual repetition of things. When we're children, we have to learn how to do things. In other words, when I learned to write my name, I learned block letters, then I learned cursive. And I don't know if anybody remembers this, but this was actually fun. It was actually exciting. It was actually interesting. And I wrote my name, and I wrote cursive. When I write my name now, and I think most people do, once in a while I'll notice myself writing it, but my penmanship has deteriorated. I don't pay a lot of attention to the way I write my name. It's just becomes automatic. So what happened is, this normal state of consciousness, the one we were sort of playing with when we were standing, it allows us to learn things. It actually employs the sovereign learner. We learn to walk, we don't recognize it, but we're studying, we're down there on the floor, and we're actually studying people for a long time. How they stand, how they move, and then gradually we integrate the three parts of ourselves, our cognitive, our emotional, because we want to stand, and our body, and we go and we get up there and we start balancing. All right? What happens after a period of time is we learn to walk. Same thing. We take a step and we fall and we learn to walk. But what happens gradually is, because the human organism is so phenomenally developed, so complex, that whole process becomes automatic and habitual. And in the process of it becoming automatic and habitual, over thousands of years, and through this automatic behavior, our parents, our parents' parents, and going back generations, develop a new type of consciousness. It's not self-consciousness. It's not fully awake when we were standing, similar to like how we were getting impressions of ourselves. I'm assuming most people did. They were breathing. But it's an in-between state of consciousness. It can do everything it has to do in life, and then if it bangs its knee, it goes, oh, and it's paying a lot of attention to the knee, but how did I bang my knee? So it does things automatically, habitually, and it does things by imitating other people. Our parents behave in a certain way, we imitate them. We don't think, oh, I'm going to behave like my dad, who's always afraid of everything, or I'm going to behave like my mother, who gets angry if I don't put things away, or vice versa. We just see them acting that way, and then we become real careful about the way we do things, just like mom, or we are real cautious. In other words, we don't want something bad to happen. Our dad is always saying, you know, if you don't do this, something bad will happen. What happens is we develop our consciousness. We develop this waking state of consciousness. So going back to Christian's question, or the comment he made about, if we get into that state of being self-conscious, if and when, you know, perhaps I meditate, or other times, something serious happens, you have an extremely difficult fight with a partner, there's the death of someone, or you have a near-death experience, you will get self-conscious. You will come right to the present moment and you will be aware of the fact that you're existing. What would happen if there was a method or a way where you could actually be in that state of consciousness without meditating? And when I only say, when I say without meditating, I mean that it wouldn't be just being still, but you could actually learn to be present that way, self-conscious, maybe not every moment, but in the midst of your daily life. That's basically what Gurdjieff's work was about. He taught people, gave them tools to allow them in the midst of life to go ahead and find and learn to be able to be more, not necessarily only doing all the things we do during the day, but to be, to actually be, to have experiences. And this is actually something we want. It's one of the reasons that people go on vacation. One of the reasons people go to foreign countries. They get to wake up a little bit. They get to come out of the sleeping waking state and they're getting more impressions. They're getting more experiences. Or another reason that people do drugs. I'm not making drugs bad here, but what happens with drugs is, especially like things like methamphetamine, all right, even caffeine to a slight degree, what it does is it pops you out of speed. What it does is it takes you out of sleeping waking and it brings you into self-consciousness. The hallucinogens such as mescaline, mushrooms, LSD, psilocybin, ecstasy, what they do is they bring you out of this waking sleeping state and they pop you up into first self-consciousness, and then you get a taste of objective consciousness or cosmic consciousness. So point being is the human organism can develop very different levels of consciousness. It can develop different levels of consciousness and our life experience can be very different. But for the most part, it doesn't happen unless people are able to see, firstly, that they live in this waking sleeping state, and secondly, if they're willing to make some effort and learn to make an effort to actually wake up, to be present, to learn to be present. So that was, I'm giving you sort of like the psychological, the systematic aspect of Gurdjieff's work. He also really began to look at bigger questions, and he started with a very basic question. Why are things happening the way they are on the planet? Why are people killing each other? And secondarily, is there some purpose to human life? Is there some purpose first to life? And secondly, is there a purpose to human life? And leaving out the concept of God even for a while here, is there an actual thing we're supposed to be doing? And he found actually that there was, that we had a very definite purpose here. We're very sophisticated animals. We have these frontal lobes that can imagine and can create things and do things. We're able to handle the unknown. And what I mean by that is we can handle changing situations very rapidly and creatively, and we can do things that no other animal can do. We can handle hazard. And what I mean by that is bird, a dog, a worm, they can handle a little bit of change in their environment, but human beings can handle dramatic changes in their environment. And because we have the frontal lobes, we can do that. And Gurdjieff said we were three-brained. And this was the first Again, he's making these statements in 1912, 1915. He says, three brains. That concept didn't enter current psychology until the triune brain. It was, you know, 15, 20 years ago again. And Gurdjieff was writing about it in 1912, 1915. What does he mean? He means that we have a head brain, which psychology likes to say everything's happening right here, and they study it like crazy, and they go, oh, the reason you have Alzheimer's, the reason you have this problem is because this little part inside the brain, this is what the problem is. Gurdjieff said, actually, no, you have three very distinct brains. Head brain, cognitive, heart brain. In other words, solar plexus. There was a brain here, he said, actually, and that's where people, when you worry and you're really afraid, you're anxious and you feel anxiety, most people, it's here, all right? And the other brain, he says, basically, is the spinal cord itself, all right? And then he went on, actually, he named another four brains. Very strange. He says, we have one very definite brain, and it's a sexual brain, sexual center. Slightly different in men than women, but you can see that that particular brain or that particular aspect of human beings has a lot of effect on our society. Advertising, the way we dress, the way we look, the way we want to appear. So Gurdjieff goes on and he names those brains. And he also talks about two other brains, two other possibilities. He calls them higher emotional, higher intellectual. We get a glimpse of those through psychedelics, through peak experience, through certain types of work that you could do. If you were to meditate for a week, we might come in contact with a different level of balance. So he had a very interesting view of human beings, and he said that we have a very specific purpose here. I'm going to stop talking for a second because I'm curious what, if anyone has any questions. Jim?
Several times you've used some phrases like such and such a mechanism was placed in the human organism.
I didn't use that tonight, did I?
I have to start because I have the same question.
Oh, really? Oh.
And I don't know whether that's just a way of speaking, but when it brings to my mind a different view of the human being than, say, evolutionary theorists wouldn't describe it as, you know, such and such a mechanism was placed in the organism. They would say it grew out of the forces of nature interacting with the organism and selecting for. So I was wondering if you could comment on that.
So Gurdjieff's work is very anti-evolutionary in the sense of, he would say actually we're in a process of de-evolution. And I don't know if I wouldn't want to say that the mechanism was placed inside of us, but one of the things that fascinated me about his work was this whole concept of, you know, in all the religions, of sin, of the fact that we've done something wrong, of that whole thing. Gurdjieff goes in a very different direction. He says, in fact, that our current problem, both as human beings and the problem on the planet, we don't get the whole responsibility. He says there's something that in fact happened to us very early on in our development. And the thing that happens, whether you take it as whether you're speaking parabolically, meaning like in a parable, the way he lays it out, or whether you're talking psychologically, is he says that something happens in the psyche, again, similar to what I was describing earlier when Robert gave when he asked me about Kundabuffer.
there's something that happens in our psyche as this middle phase of waking, sleeping, this unnatural state is formed. There's something that's actually happened in the human psyche to create a difficulty for us. And you could call it a mechanism. You could say an organ was placed within us. You can say that there's something like Kunda buffer that doesn't allow us to be fully integrated. We have a consciousness, but we also recognize there's a whole bunch of unconscious stuff running around here. It's almost like the consciousness has been split with a horizontal line. And also, we are multiplicity. We have many different parts that don't all necessarily know each other. So part of his work and part of the tools he brings is an is how to study oneself. This is what Susan mentioned. In other words, to observe oneself, to find out about oneself, to actually learn to look at oneself, be interested in oneself, and to be compassionate with what you find. Because the problem with the way we are is not completely or wholly ours. All right? And then he also goes on to say that there has been an attempt to correct for this, what I'm going to call this abnormal state of consciousness that we're stuck in. Judaism was an attempt. Christianity was a renewal. Buddhism was an attempt. The Muslim religion was an attempt. All of these in their infancy, in their original structure, and then the Egyptian, actually before Judaism, they were all attempts to create in the human being the natural normal state of self-consciousness, to bring us back, to make a corrective move that would help us to come into our normal state of consciousness. But what's happened is each of those methods, in a very short period of time, was degraded. It was degraded because many different reasons, but to a certain degree, mainly because the very level of consciousness that human beings were stuck in my opinion, this waking-sleeping state, it created something false in them. It creates, we might call it a false personality, or something which isn't really essentially them. And because of that, they move toward power. They move toward rigidity, setting down rules. They move toward fundamentalist ways of thinking. And we can see the results of that today in the Muslim culture. Okay, they see it's happening all over the place. We see it in this country here. We see it in fundamentalism, whether it's extreme Christianity or extreme Judaism or extreme whatever it may be. It's fundamental. People get, instead of people opening up, developing like a flower and becoming who they could be in their essential selves, people tend to get narrow. They tend to become fearful. They tend to then do something which is very problematic. Remember I was talking about fear earlier? Fear, natural affect, supposed to use it for our growth, supposed to be there to tell us when harm is going to occur. What happens is, because we get dysregulated in terms of fear, and also anger gets very dysregulated gradually in human beings, not talking over centuries. Anger originally, and the original affect, is you notice harm being done. You notice a child being abused, or you're hurt, or something is done that's not right, and you feel anger. I was in a restaurant about 2 years ago, Gary Chu's in Santa Rosa, having lunch with someone, and family walked in, two children, man and a woman. They sat down, and there was one boy who was about 11 years old,
and they were sitting there, and I couldn't hear what was happening, but all of a sudden the man reaches over and hits the child next to him, 11 years old, hits him across the back of the head rather violently. Okay? Can you feel what comes up a little bit? Right? I was angry. I got immediately angry because it was the harm. This was not right. This little boy was developmentally disabled. All right? And he had been doing something the father didn't like. So I was poised to call 911. Okay? I was going to actually report it, child abuse. And anybody can do that. Anyone can report child abuse. And then a couple of minutes went by, I'm going, what is the right thing to do in the situation? And then the father, I could see the father reach over and actually apologize and say, I realize I lost control here, wasn't right, and tried to comfort the child. And I felt at that point I didn't know whether it would be useful. But anger is that natural, it's a natural thing. We're not going to say we're supposed to feel it, but it's there for a reason. But what happens with anger is it has become in our society, in our world, it has become a default emotion, meaning that we are it's more difficult for us to feel the sadness, grief, and loss, which would move us toward compassion, empathy, caring, valuation. So what we do instead of that, you know, you've got anger and fear, they're both dysregulated a little bit in the culture. What happens is you get violence. You see, so what anger does, it gets associated with something. It gets associated with things such as that person isn't worshiping correctly. It's not the right way to worship. So you have a movement now in the Middle East, such as ISIS, which really is, their worldview is very different than our worldview. They are really on the mythical level, and they want to destroy everything that is here. But they have moved now, that anger coming from poverty, loss, frustration, fear, all of that is submerged, and what you get is you get violence. So I'm just trying to, you know, relate how these things relate. Please.
How do we know that this is new? This sounds like it could be Homo sapiens from the beginning of time.
How do we know that it's not just an animalistic evolutionary thing that's happened? Yeah.
Well, that it's not even evolutionary. It sounds like we could have been this way from the beginning.
Absolutely. We could have been this way from the beginning. Perhaps. Okay? According to Gurdjieff's ideas, and again, not only his ideas, but what's unearthed, okay, and is there in symbol and parable throughout written history, is something actually happens, that there is a fall, you know, Garden of Eden, you see it there running around. In other words, there's a degradation.
I see, sure.
There's a degradation of our experience, of the human experience. And you can look at religion in its purest form, and you can see even like the Ten Commandments. Well, what are they? Thou shalt not kill. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. So, and yet, nobody's able to do these things. Okay. So, Gurdjieff's work became a work of helping people to gain the tools to first of all study themselves, because the problem he was up against is, why would anybody wish to actually develop an inner life or study themselves or wake up if they already felt that they're awake? In other words...
Okay, I got a question.
Please.
All right, so, I mean, you can spend your life looking at yourself. Honestly.
Right.
But the whole idea of being is to turn around and realize that in you, in all of us, every human, there's a timeless, infinite place. And we spend our entire lives, rather than looking at that, we spend our entire lives trying to figure shit out. So it just seems like it's like not a waste of time, but it is a waste of time when the whole question, the crux of the problem is, the refusal for all of us to actually turn around and look and say, I am timeless, infinite, in myself. And everything else is not real, because as you say, it's temporal. What I'm saying right now will be gone in a millionth of a second. It's gone. And what I say then, next, it's gone. It's all gone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can look for your chief weakness, you can do the whole deal.
Mm-hmm.
You can run the whole game.
Right.
But in the end, you only are this timeless, infinite thing, because guess what? This thing's going to die.
The physical body is going to die. Absolutely. There's no question about it.
Unless I realize that for myself, that I am this timeless, infinite thing,
mm-hmm.
which brings me completion to my life and meaning and love and the whole shebang,
mm-hmm.
it's all a waste of time.
Yeah, I can see that you can go in that direction very easily. And Gurdjieff actually, you actually enter into an area here where he talks about things that are a little bit. There are possibilities for us. The approach you have is pretty much what's called non-dual. In other words, so it's this concept that there is this part. Okay. So, one of the difficulties...
But can you actually build, I mean, this timeless, infinite space, can you actually build it into, like, the permanent eye and all that stuff? I mean, is that actually it? Or is it... Can you take something that's timeless... and infinite in nature and build it into something else. Really?
Well, let's put it this way. If you were able to remember that you are a timeless, infinite organism, okay, and to treat others in that way, and to treat your life and live your life in that way.
Right, that's the problem.
Absolutely, if you're able to do that. But the difficulty is, from my experience, all right, is in order to do that, I have to know myself and understand myself and find out how I get caught up, how I'm identified from moment to moment to moment. Somebody calls me and they speak to me in a certain way, I'm suddenly angry. I'm out of touch completely with the fact that I'm this infinite, pure being. So in order to get to where you're talking about, I wouldn't argue with where you want to head. There's a certain work that has to be done. I need to know and understand myself and know where I get caught, and know how to wake up and come back to the place that you're talking about.
So I'll just take that devil's
advocate part. Sure.
It's like, you can do that, of course. You can work on yourself your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, can't that be a trap by itself?
Certainly. If you become completely identified with it, and if you don't... Let me put forth this possibility. Okay. The human organism, what do I know about it? What do I understand about it? In other words, because I can have this idea, you know, I'm in this infinite being, but I'll give you a simple example. In current modern thought, we have one food. We eat normal food. All right? Everybody here ate, they all came in, right? In this particular system, because this relates to this idea of perhaps the possibility of another, of a different level of existence, Gurdjieff points out two other foods. All right? First food he points out, which, and again, going to Berkeley, when I went to Berkeley, it was the number one university in the world. All right? That's what it was, 1964, 65, number one in the world. I don't know how they figured that out. But, you know, it's like, well, these people, well, we'll make that one number one, and we're going to make Oxford number two. Air. Air is a food. All right? Now, simple example. And again, this is nothing about negative about truck drivers. But if you take an artist and the truck driver, and they're both standing looking at a painting in the De Jong, and they both stand there and look. The painter has painted all his life, and he realizes how hard it is to do, looking at this beautiful painting, how hard it is to do that. He's going to take from this painting quite a bit, something that's very different than the truck driver. The truck driver is looking at it and going, yeah, I see it. Visually, they're both taking the same thing, all right? But I'm going to say, hypothetically, the experience of the artist is getting more.
Okay.
Okay. Follow for a second. I'm getting more. All right. Air is a food. All right. Regular food, 30 days to 45 days. If you have a little bit of water, without it, you can survive. Air, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, you die. Then Gurdjieff points out another food, not in current, even thought of as current, currently, to this day, impressions. Okay? So the artist is getting impressions. All right? And what happens is, when you get impressions, the more impressions you get, and the more you understand the impressions you get, the more you are alive. Even in the sense of being in contact with this infinite part that you're taking, that you're talking about. So the question becomes, really in life, how do I gain impressions, not only of myself, but impressions of life? And people do this unconsciously, certain people. They want to go to the theater. They want to travel. They want to be engaged and have friendships. They're desperate for real impressions. So the human organism wants impressions. We never consider the fact that these three foods, three distinct foods that we're taking in every moment, like right now. By the way, Gurdjieff says, if impressions stop for a mini second, you instantaneously die. All right? It's not like air, it's not like water, it's not like regular food, the air, you know, water and regular food. So in other words, right now as we're sitting here, there are millions of impressions that each of us are taking in. And we don't make use of them. And the most important impressions would come from actually coming into a state of self-consciousness. And then the question would be, what could we know and understand about life, which wouldn't be theoretical? It wouldn't be simply, well, we're all one, and when I die, I'm going to go back out into this oneness, and there might be other levels of understanding that would be possible for us. I'm throwing that out theoretically. It doesn't answer your question or address it. But I'm hearing you say, why bother doing all this work if, in fact, we're just this infinite thing anyway? And I'd say the only answer would be, you'd have to do the work and know all your different parts to get a taste of what that answer is. Because then you can own it. You can feel it a little bit more. I've had to answer it for myself.
Oh, okay. So I actually don't believe
that.
Sure. But... okay, so we got the truck driver and mm-hmm. we got the artist.
Right.
Goes into the deal. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this painting is still there, but the Al Greco is John DeBaptiste.
Right.
So the artist sees the technique, the color, the pigments, the interaction of time and atmosphere and light on the mm-hmm. painting, and how it's changing, and how good he was at doing the forms and his proportions. Everything's really true. The truck driver walks in and sees the intention of the painting, which is transformation. He takes it in, and the painting transforms it.
Not usually.
But
how can you say that?
But I spend a lot of time in museums.
I'm an artist.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can't say that. You don't know.
That's true. I don't really know. I'm trying to give you...
You're judging some guy that you don't know.
I'm just trying to give you an analogy for when we take in different things depending upon our level of consciousness and how conscious we are.
You know, so I was, of course, a student of Gurdjieff for a long time.
You were what?
A student of Gurdjieff for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Amongst other things. And I just, you know, I have problems with it. I just feel that after all that work, in the end, you turn around and you see this infinite place in me that I know that was before this body and will be after this body.
How do you know?
Because I know.
How?
I'm sure of it.
How do you know?
I don't know, but I know.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubts. I grew up having past life memories.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a full-on kundalini
mm-hmm.
experience.
Mm-hmm.
I've been through them.
How do you know they were your?
In the universe.
How do you know they were your experiences?
They were my experiences. I experienced them.
How do you know you didn't experience something that belonged to other individuals?
Well, I don't, but I know that I experienced it.
I wouldn't argue that you've experienced
it. I didn't have those experiences in school.
Mm-hmm. Who did you study with?
Alex Horn.
Alex Horn had nothing to do with Gurdjieff.
I realize that.
Alex Horn, please, excuse me, Robert. Yeah. Alex Horn was a charlatan. He beat women up. He had nothing at all to do with esoteric ideas. He did not know anything. I met Alex Horn. I knew Alex Horn. I knew many people in the group. He had no idea whatsoever. His wife, Ann Horn, started a group, had 150 people, educated 300 children. In other words, in those children, some of them are remarkable. So in other words, Alex Horn doesn't even had nothing to do with Gurdjieff. Nothing.
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to argue with it because I actually agree with you. So I'm not going to, it's just you.
Yeah, it's very distorted, yeah.
I mean, but the ideas.
Yeah.
But it's just like, it doesn't...
I hear that there's an aspect of it that doesn't... I really hear that it doesn't work for you in the sense of making the effort to understand and know oneself.
It's not even that, because at some point you have to say, I am this person. I'm not a monster, or I'm not this or that, but I'm this person, that I'm this organism, and this organism here simply is going to pass on, but I am not. But even as I say it, I experience it as something else.
So one of the difficulties is that, and I'd have to give you not an analogy, but the notion of that there's different types of work. In other words, there are basically three specific ways that people work, all right? In other words, there's the work on the physical body, there's the work on the emotional body, there's the work on this intellectual body, all right? What you're saying is from the non-dual, it's very much a head-oriented cognitive way of working. The other ways, the way of the sadhu or the fakir in India, they work on the physical body, they make an entrance into this higher emotional state and higher intellectual state where your ideas are coming from. The way of the monk or the spiritual way, they work mainly on the emotional part and they enter this other fourth level, you could call it, this higher emotional, higher intellectual state. Okay? The way original yoga, which was there were five or six types of yoga, it's an intellectual way, all right? Raja, in other words, it's a way of entering the higher state, these states that can be experienced that you're talking about, by doing that. And the difficulty with those three ways, and the reason this is called the fourth way, is because each of them leaves the other two relatively undeveloped. In other words, the sadhu, I don't know if you've ever seen them in India, the fakirs, they're not very they don't get to develop emotionally, they don't get to develop intellectually. Monks, people who are just religious, and there are a couple of real religious orders like that, they don't get a chance to completely develop experience of life, of being really in this life, okay, in a certain way, and develop the cognitive, and to develop the body, all right? And then the intellectual, the cognitive ways, the ways of a limited yoga, one yoga, develops the head brain, doesn't get a chance to develop the other aspects of yoga. All right. In other words, Bhakti yoga, which is yoga of right living. So what happens is each of them leaves out something. Okay, so there's something to be developed when all three of these parts get developed and integrated. That's what Gurdjieff called the fourth way.
But what does it matter? Because in the end, you simply are this other thing that's not your body.
The reason it matters is because you get an opportunity in this life to be able to actually serve the purpose for which human beings were developed, to produce a vibration which is a real vibration, to be real men and women, more fully, more real men and women. And you can know that about people by their very... Well, first of all, more important thing is to be able to experience it yourself, to what it's like to be really integrated in many ways, to have the three centers come together and be able to act. That's a gift. It just doesn't happen, I know from my own experience. So you get to do that. You get to live that. And then perhaps your perception is different. In other words, your perception is the perception which is more balanced, and you can be more compassionate with others regardless of how you're treated, regardless of whether they're awake or not awake. So you get to develop these other human capacities, which are not that easy to develop, and you get to live your life out that way with them being developed to some extent. So that's the advantage that I see. I'm not going to disagree. This thing's going to go. It's going to die. Gurdjieff says, in fact, that there are very specific possibilities for the human organism that are rarely developed. One of them is the possibility of an actual other creation inside the human organism, something that can actually continue beyond the physical body. You know, so those are potentials. We're able to make another person outside of us.
In fact, you already have that.
No, you don't. This is one of the great difficulties with the remnants of what's been left over through history. The concept of an astral body, that we already have that, or the concept of the soul. And this again here is where these ideas diverge completely from current thinking in every religion. Gurdjieff says you have the possibility of a soul, depending upon how you live, whether you make an effort to actually, in a way, to work to understand yourself and create one. He says the concept that you continue on in a form that you know, not possible. It would be like each of us could be a great pianist, but if I never get a piano and I don't practice the piano, you're not going to be a great pianist. Likewise, you have the capability of another body, of two other bodies, actually. This has to do with soul. This has to do with real soul. But it's not something that just happens. This is where Gurdjieff diverges from every other line. He's saying, in fact, there has to be an effort made in life to understand oneself, to know oneself, to actually learn to do conscious labor and voluntary conscious labor and intentional suffering, meaning that you make use of your activities. You are willing to take on something that's difficult because it has a real meaning. This is one of the reasons that we're supposed to be here, is we're one of the only organisms that can suffer. I don't like the word suffer. Not a better word in English. It really means intentional action. We're one of the only organisms on the planet that can make a plan and take an intentional action. Every other organism is instinctive. It's instinctive. It works instinctively. And remarkably, but we're the only one that can lay out something and make an intentional thing, that we can go and take care of someone who is ill and needs to be taken care of and do that. Christian.
So soul is not something that we have inherently, it's something we create through our actions and our understanding. If I'm hearing you right.
We have it in potential, in other words, it exists in embryo. All right. Whether it's brought into existence within us depends upon how we live and the actions that we take. I mean, it's not that complex. In other words, I personally don't see how anything that ISIS is doing in terms of the killing can be from a higher level or moving toward a higher level. At the instinctive, at the gut level, I could be all wrong. But at the gut level, emotionally, it doesn't sit right. So potentially, we absolutely can create soul. How many people are interested in that? Not a lot. And one of the great difficulties for us has been, if everybody is told through their religion that you already have this thing, and you don't have to do anything, you don't have to work, you don't have to make any effort, then why would anyone do anything?
Well, Hillman talks about how we go through our experiences and the way that we experience them, feel them, and move into them and actually acknowledge them is what brings us into soul. And so he talks about making soul.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's exactly, I agree with him 100%. It's engaging in one's life and you're actually making soul. You're creating it. The raw blocks are there. And even as a child, most people have a sense that there's a potential in them, that something of a different nature is there. It's before personality comes on, before being concerned about how this is going across to you, or how, you know, am I being seen in the right way, or I'm so concerned. It's before all of that. There's something in us as a child that knows, oh, I have a potential here, and I can develop it. But it's limited by the society, limited by your parents, limited by situations you come in contact with in life. So the quote-unquote Gurdjieff work, or the work, is a way to study oneself, from my experience, and to develop self-compassion. Because that's a key, because what happens, what I've seen happening throughout every major religion or dogma, doesn't make any difference, or philosophy, is there's a tendency to rigidify that happens in religion. And what happens is it kills what's supposed to be happening. It kills it. And there's a reason for it. There's a glitch in us psychologically. We have a tendency, I have a tendency, to talk about myself, to go black and white, to go good and bad. That little simple tendency, good and evil, black and white, destroys the ability to see the other, to see the essence that's there in the other, to recognize who the person is. It destroys the possibility of religions, because it makes you do these things only, you don't do these other things. You see what I'm saying? In other words, it's exclusive. It doesn't allow you to expand. That little glitch, it's a cause of self-criticism in individuals, and it causes criticism toward others. Doesn't really let them in completely. It's a soul killer in a lot of ways. Shame, it uses shame. It uses violence toward the self, toward others. And what happens gradually is the possibility of knowing oneself or making use of religion, it becomes just acting out. People go to church and they say, well, yeah, I go to church, I'm a good Catholic, but they don't even believe it. And they'll even say that. They'll say, I'm a recovering Catholic. You know, they're recovering from the sins. I have a very good friend, and he's 80 now. He said, you know, I was in the seminary for 2 years at age 18. Everything was a sin. If I did it, it was a sin. If I didn't do it, it was a sin. Everything was a sin. He said that I could not, I realized even then at age 18, something was off. You know? So, in my opinion, I agree with him. So, soul is a possibility. Other questions, comments?
Yeah.
Please.
The state of consciousness that one's in, when, for example, when it's absorbed.
A little louder for me.
When you're absorbed in a task, like, for example, you get absorbed in, two different things for me. One would be, like, just getting absorbed in my work, which is a lot of fun. I enjoy doing it. And or getting involved in an art project, where time goes by and you're just focusing on the art project, but there's none of that sense of, I am doing an art project, how am I feeling right now, how am I balancing, how am I doing this, that kind of self-mind. Is that a different state, or is that just the state of, or the art state, which is does feel different, and the state of just being absorbed, like that whole idea of forgetting the self is to find the self, where that sort of self-conscious of how am I doing?
It's not so much how, really. It's that I am. And I'll give it. It's like, I could be here speaking with you, and I can do it pretty automatically, all right? And it takes a certain level of consciousness to be able to do that. If at the same time I was doing that, I was able to be self-conscious, the only difference would be, it's very subtle, is there'd be something in me that would be aware that I'm speaking to you. something would be in me at that very moment. It's like a double consciousness. It's conscious of what I have to do and say, but there's a part of me that's also conscious that I'm existing and doing it in the moment. That's what the definition is of awareness would be. So if you're working on an art project, you could work on it and do a really good job. And if there's another part of you that you bring that's there, just going, it recognizes you're existing. When you're a child and you learn to walk or you learn to write, you learn to do things, that part is alive until about, I would say, age 10. All it's doing is it's sort of recording. Oh, I'm doing this. And you go, God, that's great. I can make something. I remember making a glass case for my mother at about age nine, and I'm in a camp, and I'm sewing through the yellow velvet. Not velvet, but type of velvet-like material. I'm sewing that thing. I don't forget that. There was something in me that was 100% present, exclusive of the fact that I had it, that it took care to do what I was doing. It was added to it, the awareness. That part, in my experience, goes to sleep in children, usually age 10 or 12. And the reason it goes to sleep is because they're imitating others. They're imitating the teacher. The teacher's up there just automatically doing it, and everybody's saying, memorize this, memorize that, read your history, and they're going, oh, okay, I'll read it. And it becomes memorization, but the part that was alive and awake is gone to sleep. Please, Betty.
Would you discuss flow? Because I think what she's talking about is flow, where you're really not conscious of time passing. You're so engaged in mm-hmm. what you're doing that it's not automatic exactly, but you're not thinking, oh, I'm doing this and so on.
No, but there's something when you're in flow. Csikszentmihalyi's flow, that concept.
Yes.
There's something there in flow, which is there's a realization inside, this is a different state. There's something in you recognizing in the moment. It's not after the fact. And even after the fact, you go, that was different. And that is, I'm not going to make a distinction between flow and self-consciousness, because there's something there that's very special. Please, Susan.
I want to check something out with you.
Sure.
It feels to me like when I'm self-conscious and aware of that,
mm-hmm.
I'm taking in more impressions.
Absolutely.
In a sense. I'm more sensitive, and I'm getting more nourishment.
Absolutely.
You know, and I need less food, and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I'm more connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I've found more recently when I feel that, I can be more generous with others. You know, that's a different kind of experience that comes out of this.
I agree 100%. It's because impressions.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting fed at the level of impressions. Impressions and air are two foods that are not just for the physical body. And again, this is something we don't normally ever think about. When two people breathe, they don't take exactly the same thing out of the air. We don't even think at that level. In other words, we think, well, people breathe and they just take out the same stuff. And if you look at different yogas and different things in the Far East, you'll see there's a lot of stuff going on with breathing. Well, why all the interest in breathing? It's the remnants, not necessarily correct, but it's the remnants of a realization that if you were to breathe consciously, even, and there's a whole, Vipassana is basically based on that. And ideally, they're not changing the depth of the breath or the speed of the breath, the rate. You are going to take something different out of the air than if I'm in Costco running around trying to figure out what I should get, or I'm angry at my children, or I'm angry that somebody didn't show up for therapy. You're going to take something different out of the air. And likewise, you're in the state and you're able to observe or be present, you are going to feed or take out something different from your impressions. Impressions are going to be multiplied, and it has an effect on you. You're different. So you get to live in a different way. I have to stop, but...
So are enlightened people skinnier?
Popped into my head. In other words, you need less food.
That actually, the connection would be, if I was nourished more in that way and understood myself more, what's going on inside me, including the disharmonies and the sufferings that are going on, I wouldn't need to eat the gallon of ice cream because to soothe myself. So, yes. But I would also say, and you know, it's interesting because anorexia, you produce more serotonin. So when you're anorexic, you're not eating, you're making more serotonin. You're changing your state of consciousness. Feels really good. However, I would just say the caveat would be that would be also by body type. Some people tend to put on mass with eating nothing, and other people, they can eat everything and they can't put on any weight. So anyway.
Could I ask you a question before
please?
You close? We're talking about the three states.
These three centers, these three centers. Brains or centers.
I know more, I know a little bit about Jungian psychology, where there is an ego, a self, and a shadow side. And those are our three centers.
They are.
And according to Jung, those have to be held in a certain kind of tension before you can become an integrated individual.
Absolutely.
So how does that play into what Gurdjieff is advocating?
He might not use the same terminology as Jung is talking about in that case, but the notion would be the ideal situation would be... Do you play a musical instrument?
No.
Well, one of the reasons that musical instruments are so wonderful is they integrate the three parts. The head brain, the heart, and the body have to get integrated. To play piano, it's like what it is a three-brained activity. It's integrated. One of the reasons people love music, and even if you don't play an instrument, you love music because there's something in you recognizing at a very deep level, this is an effort that somebody is making to create this, and it's coming from three different levels, and it affects you here, here, and it affects the human body. So integrated when three parts are together, there's a possibility of being more fully integrated human being.
Is that the same for choral singing?
Absolutely.
How about dancing?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons, one of the major things that Gurdjieff brought is he brought these movements, very complex movements, to music. But it wasn't free form, all right? It required head. And I'm not making freeform bad. I don't want anyone, Zeus or anybody, anyone here in Sebastopol to hear me. Not making it bad. But it requires head, heart, body to do this. Ballet, flamenco, folk dance. Every culture had a type of dance. And through dance, information was actually passed from culture in the culture. So anyway... The main piece I wanted to bring was get to be interested in your own development, to become an explorer, to go ahead and get some more impressions of yourself and be interested in that, because that actually builds who we are as human beings. And to always have some compassion there with it, because it's so easy to have it go off into good, bad. And that really hasn't worked for religion. It hasn't worked in what I see with all the clients I see in terms of the self-hate or hatred of others. In other words, so there has to be, as you look at yourself and as you develop yourself, there has to be this little bit, like salt for a meal, has to be a bit of self-compassion. And then the possibility is there to have compassion for others. That we're very complex organisms. So, anyway, thank you.
And, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you on behalf of Many Rivers for injecting a dose of some not good, bad consciousness here in our store. I want to, as is our custom, let you know that we have a donation bowl over on the counter. We encourage you to contribute to it, which we share with our speakers to further their work and also to help maintain, to help maintain this space for further such events. We also have our speakers' a book here, some other relevant books as well. We will hope to get him back at a future date. And we hope to get you guys back at a future date, perhaps when the shelves make it possible to check out other things that you could purchase beyond just these books here. And thank you again for coming tonight.
Thank you.